Geekscape.com. Julian the Apostate and the Jews, taken from The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History by E. Michael Jones. Origen wrote, "Heretics and Jews are grouped together as the conventicle of the wicked who build in vain," over a century before Julian became emperor. But he could not have more accurately described Julian's project to rebuild the temple, or its outcome. Under Julian, 361 to 63, we are told there was a revival of Jewish national ambition connected with the attempt to rebuild the temple. The Jews of Antioch were certainly involved in this revival. In fact, the Jews fitted well into Julian's plan to restore paganism. Gretz says, "Julian's reign was a period of extreme happiness for the Jews of the Roman Empire, and Julian was greatly impressed by the god of Judaism. But the latter seems unlikely, given his initiation into the Eleusinian mysteries and his desire to restore the pagan gods. Julian's attraction to the Jews was more political than theological, which historians closer to his time recognized." Rufinus does not share Gretz's feeling that Julian was greatly impressed by the god of Judaism. Rufinus says in Historia Ecclesiastica, written around 400 AD, "So great was Julian's subtlety and shrewdness as to land even the unfortunate Jews in illusory expectations to which he himself was subject. He summoned them and confronted them with the question of why they do not perform sacrifices, although their laws obligate them to do so. But they, sensing the opportunity of the moment, said, 'We can do so only in the temple of Jerusalem, for such is the command of the law.' Having obtained from him the permission to start with the work of reconstruction, they became so emboldened in their insolence as to make it appear that a prophet of theirs had come to them. From all regions and provinces there came Jews to start with the reconstruction of the temple, which had long ago been consumed with fire. With the permission of the emperor's representative, they used public and private means to proceed in great haste. Meanwhile, they started insulting our fellow Christians, as if the Jews' old kingdom were about to be reinstated. As the Jews grew in confidence and pride, they menaced Christians ever more heatedly." Socrates is more pointed in exposing Julian's political manipulation of the Jews and their messianic hopes. "Julian," says Socrates, "thought to grieve the Christians by favouring the Jews, who are their most inveterate enemies. But perhaps he also calculated upon persuading the Jews to embrace paganism and sacrifices, for they were only acquainted with the mere letter of Scripture, and could not, like the Christians and a few of the wisest among the Hebrews, discern the hidden meaning. The emperor, the other pagans, and all the Jews regarded every other undertaking as secondary in importance to this. Although the pagans were not well disposed towards the Jews, yet they assisted them in their enterprise, because they reckoned upon its ultimate success, and hoped by this means to falsify the prophecies of Christ." An educated man, Julian understood the thrust of Christian anti-Jewish polemic. The Christians claimed that destruction of the temple proved the superiority of Christianity, and that Christianity had superseded Judaism as the new Israel. Julian's desire to rebuild the temple fits squarely into the trajectory of anti-Jewish Christian polemic. To blunt Christian claims, he could find no more willing allies than the Jews, who hated Christians and were eager to collaborate with those who held political power. The Jews had cried that they had no king but Caesar, and now Caesar was reaching out to them, willing to support their deepest aspirations, the restoration of Jerusalem and its temple. In a letter to the community of the Jews, Julian promised, "I will use all my zeal to make the temple of the Most High God rise again." His reference to the Most High God flattered his Jewish audience, and Gretz was still taken in by the flattery a millennium and a half later. In his letter, Julian affirmed that the temple in Jerusalem alone was recognized by the Torah, and that it would have to be rebuilt before the Jews again had sacred precincts and altars for sacrifice, thereby confirming everything the Christian fathers had said about the church as the new Israel. He also upped the ante. If he could build the temple, he could reverse the course of history, prove that Christianity was a hoax, and prove that he himself was a god worthy of induction into the pantheon he was reconstructing. From a theological viewpoint, the decision to rebuild the temple was the most ambitious construction project in history. The high priest of the Hellenes would embarrass the god of the Galileans on his own terrain, making him out to be a charlatan. St. John Chrysostom attributes more wickedness to Julian and more slyness to the Jews. Julian, according to Chrysostom, born 14 years before Julian's reign and ordained a priest 20 years after Julian's death, surpassed all the emperors in irreligion. He did not begin by enlisting the Jews in his project to re-paganize the Roman Empire. Rather, he invited the Jews to sacrifice to idols in an attempt to drag them to his own level of ungodliness. The Jews were cleverer than the emperor. They turned his project to their advantage, saying, "If you wish to see us offer sacrifices, give us back Jerusalem. Rebuild the temple, show us the Holy of Holies, restore the altar, and we will offer sacrifices again, just as we did before." But the sacrifices the Jews promised were not going to be to Roman gods. Chrysostom too felt, "All Jews are responsible for Christ's passion and death, that they have been repudiated and cursed by God, and that they stand condemned out of the mouths of their own prophets." Like Julian, Chrysostom had received an excellent education in the Greek Paedia. Like Julian, Chrysostom saw the Jew as the primary enemy of the Christian. Anyone who saw the church as a danger to the security of state and society, as Julian did, would favour Judaism, to remove Christianity as paganism's chief rival. The stage was set for a battle of wills in which the emperor would attempt to force God's hand. Like latter-day evangelicals who show up at the Temple Mount in Jerusalem with dynamite to usher in Armageddon by blowing up the mosque built on the temple's foundations, Julian would reverse the course of history by resurrecting the Jewish priesthood, sacrifice, and temple. Julian's claim was daring, but not preposterous, for as St. John Chrysostom makes clear in Adversus Judaeos, Christians accepted the premises of Julian's argument. If Julian could rebuild the temple, then the Jews would be vindicated, and Christianity, the superseder, would itself be superseded. It may be difficult to imagine the construction of one building causing this, but the temple in Jerusalem wasn't just any building, it was the sine qua non of the Jewish religion. If it could be rebuilt, the Jewish religion would be re-established, and if that were to happen, Christianity's claim to be the new Israel would be over. Christianity would be one sect among many, easily accommodated into Rome's pantheon. Eusebius, in Demonstratio Evangelica, claimed the temple precincts had been completely obliterated by time and the Roman legions. The site of the temple was ploughed and cultivated by Roman citizens in a way not at all different from other such fields. Much earth and rubble, as a result, had to be removed before the foundations were laid bare and Julian's construction could begin. The Jews, blind to all things, called on the emperor for help, and the emperor happily obliged. Julian turned to Alypius distinguished prefect of Britain. Work went smoothly. At the beginning, Roman know-how combined with Jewish wealth and enthusiasm seemed unbeatable. According to Ammianus, Julian allotted enormous sums for the enterprise, sums which were augmented by contributions of the Patriarch of All Judaism and other voluntary offerings, including costly garments and jewels handed over for the purpose by Jewish women. Jewish women, according to Eusebius, even used their garments to help carry away the earth removed by diggers busy with making room for the new foundations. The lone dissenting voice was St. Cyril, Bishop of Jerusalem, who, according to Eusebius, predicted dire consequences for the day lime was mixed to make mortar for the foundation stones. The Jews scorned Cyril's prediction. The enthusiastic effort went smoothly for a while. Rubble that covered the site for centuries was removed, exposing the original foundation. But when new construction was about to begin, things started to go wrong. During the night, says Eusebius, there arose a huge storm. The earth shook, and huge balls of fire burst forth from the ground, and continued to do so through the next day. Instruments melted, workers were burnt to death, strange crosses appeared on clothes and bodies, a luminous cross shone in the sky, and the enterprise had to be abandoned. A violent tremor caused a portico to collapse, killing a number of workers. According to St. John Chrysostom, Julian overlooked nothing but worked quietly and a little at a time to bring the Jews to offer sacrifice. In this way, he expected that it would be easy for them to go from sacrifice to the worship of idols. The emperor's construction crew was about to start construction of the new temple, when, suddenly, fire leaped forth from the foundations and completely consumed not only a great number of the workmen, but even the stones piled up there to support the structure. Gregory of Nazianzen says the Jewish women carried the dirt in their lap with no consideration for their robes and for the tenderness of their bodies, because they saw in all this a work of piety, as they carried everything downwards from the temple foundations to a nearby valley. But, Gregory continues, a sudden whirlwind and the convulsion of the earth caused them to rush to a nearby church. As they, the Jewish women, reached the door of the church, which was open, suddenly those doors closed, as if by an invisible hand, which filled with fear the impious and protest the devout. It is reported unanimously and held for certain that when they tried to open the door of the church, flames that burst forth from the inside prevented them from forcing the door open. The flames then burned some of them and destroyed others. Still others lost various limbs of their bodies to the flames that burst from inside the church and burnt some of them to death. Gregory adds that those who refuse to admit the event's miraculous character do not believe in any miracle of God. Gregory, says Stanley Jackie, was fully aware of the need of being credible when reporting about truly miraculous events. He therefore scrupulously avoids embellishment in describing the second miraculous occurrence, the appearance of a cross within a luminous circle in the sky, followed by the appearance of crosses on the clothing of the Jews. Anyone who was there found, either on his vestments or on his body, a luminous sign in the form of a cross, which exceeded the beauty of anything produced by a weaver or by a painter. On seeing this, they, the Jews, were so terrified as to invoke in one voice the God of the Christians and try to expiate him with many praises and supplications. Some even went so far as to seek out our priests and were, after many prayers, admitted into the church and introduced into the greater mysteries. They had their souls purified in baptism and so profited from their terror. Again, Jackie explains why Gregory could not exaggerate, much less lie. Had he done so, he would have exposed himself to immediate rebuttal by pagan admirers of Julian, who were very numerous indeed, and were not absent even from Cappadocia, a stronghold of Christianity. But neither Gregory nor other erstwhile reporters of the event were challenged about the veracity of their presentation. Gregory was never charged of falsifying or inventing facts. St. Ambrose, a former civil servant, also could not embellish the tale because it was within the memory of those still living, and any fabrication would have undermined his credibility with the people he wanted to impress. Yet he pulls no punches in describing the incident and its meaning to the Emperor Gratian. "Have you not heard how?" Ambrose asked the emperor, in reference to a synagogue he planned to build. When Julian had ordered the Temple of Jerusalem rebuilt, those who were carrying the rubbish were burned by fire from heaven. Are you not afraid that this will happen also now? In fact, you should not have given an order such as Julian would have given. Ammianus Marcellus, Julian's pagan biographer, reports frightful balls of flame kept bursting forth near the foundations of the temple, which made it impossible to approach the place, even though Alypius pushed the work forward energetically and was assisted by the governor of the province. Alypius ordered men to their deaths by ordering them into the flames from the temple's foundations, but he eventually conceded defeat because the elements, i.e. the fire, persistently drove them back. Ammianus notes that Julian gave up the attempt. Socrates says the Jews were driven to doom by their desire to gratify their illicit passions. When God caused the earthquake to cease, the workmen who survived again returned to their task, partly because such was the edict of the emperor, and partly because they were themselves interested in the undertaking. Men, often in endeavouring to gratify their own passions, seek what is injurious to them, reject what would be truly advantageous, and are deluded by their ideas that nothing is really useful except what is agreeable to them. When once led astray by this error, they are no longer able to act in a manner conducive to their own interest, or to take warning by the calamities which are visited upon them. The Jews, I believe, were in just this state, for instead of regarding this unexpected earthquake as a manifest indication that God was opposed to the re-erection of their temple, they proceeded to recommence the work. But all parties relate that they had scarcely returned to the undertaking when fire burst suddenly from the foundations of the temple and consumed several of the workmen. Socrates concludes, "The incident is believed by all. The only discrepancy in the narrative is that some maintain that flame burst from the interior of the temple, as the workmen were striving to force an entrance, while others say that the fire proceeded directly from the earth." The explosions dumbfounded Julian and his Jewish allies. The Jews were astonished and struck with shame. Julian, formerly madly eager to finish the project, was suddenly filled with fear, afraid that fire might fall on his own head too. So he and the whole Jewish people withdrew in defeat. Chrysostom comments, "Even today, if you go into Jerusalem, you will see the bare foundation. If you ask why this is so, you will hear no explanation other than the one I gave. We are all witnesses to this, for it happened not long ago, but in our own time." Julian tried to make the best of a bad situation in his letter to a priest. According to him, the Jewish prophets who scorned the worship of idols were brought low. Julian fails to note the idea to rebuild the temple was his. Julian the idol worshipper concludes idols of all kinds are perishable, The God of the Jews may be great, Julian says, but he has not found worthy prophets and interpreters. The reason is that their souls have not been refined by a liberal education, and their eyes have not been purified by the light of study. Julian thus tried to pin the failure on the Jews. Some have claimed the explosions resulted from the seepage of petroleum, but there is no natural explanation. The Dead Sea, which contains asphalt, which does not explode, was 25 miles away and 1,000 meters lower than the temple. A recent Jewish encyclopedia entry blithely claims no fire rose from the earth to stop work on the temple, but Gretz is not as reckless with the truth. Gretz admits, on the occasion of the pulling down of the ruins and the excavation of the foundations, a fire broke out, by which several workmen lost their lives. He ascribes this subterranean conflagration to gases which had long been compressed there, and which, on being suddenly released from pressure, ignited on coming into contact with the air above. These sudden explosions, Gretz says, disheartened the workmen so that they gradually gave up work. Gretz's explanation fails twice. First, Ammianus insists frightful balls of flame kept bursting forth near the foundations of the temple, which could not occur from pent-up gas. If construction were halted by that kind of explosion, the explosion would have solved the problem. Construction could have resumed immediately. Ammianus states the fire kept bursting forth, something incompatible with pent-up gas. Secondly, Gretz overlooks the implication that flows from use of Ammianus as his source. Ammianus is a pagan with a vested interest in a non-theological explanation, unfavourable to the Christians. If there were evidence for a natural cause, Ammianus would have seized it. Julian, Gretz recounts, accused the Christians of having caused the fires to break out in the underground passages. Gretz then attempts to rebut Chrysostom's account without mentioning him by name, claiming the Christian authorities of the following generation relate the most wonderful tales of the miracles which are said to have happened during this impious rebuilding, the purpose of all of which was to warn the obdurate Jews and to glorify Christ. Gretz is playing the familiar role of the Jewish debunker, but his assessment of Chrysostom is not far off the mark. Chrysostom does assert that the attempt to rebuild the temple was an act of impiety, and that the project's failure was a warning to obdurate Jews and a vindication of Christians. Julian did not make a second attempt. Julian and the Jews recognize the explosions as a sign that the work should not continue. Julian himself was fatally wounded by a spear thrust in his side in his military campaign against the Persians, uttering, according to one account, Nennececus Galilei, just before his death, or as Swinburne rendered the phrase, "Thou hast triumphed, O pale Galilean." Another account has him saying, "Helios, thou hast ruined me." Christian legend attributes his death to Saint Mercurius, a Roman soldier martyred a century before. Saint Mercurius's role in slaying Julian was memorialized in Orthodox iconography, but it appears first in the Chronicle of John Malalas after 563. According to one account, Christ ordered Mercurius to slay Julian. Another says the Theotokos gave the order. Either way, the champion of the Jews died by the rivers of Babylon, and Jewish hopes for a rebuilt temple died with him. The Jews and the pagans were demoralized by their failure to reconstruct the temple. Gretz says, the death of Julian in the neighborhood of the Tigris deprived the Jews of the last ray of hope for a peaceful and unmolested existence. The death of Julian, for all practical purposes, ended Jewish political aspiration, certainly in Europe, for roughly a millennium. Towards the end of the 14th century, their hopes would revive briefly as they conspired with the Moors in Spain against the Reconquista, but they backed the wrong side and were expelled from Spain. Chrysostom's explanation of Julian's efforts is straightforward. It is considerably less laboured than Gretz's. The emperor and his Jewish allies failed because they failed to see that they were attempting the impossible, because if God destroyed their city, no human power could ever change what God had decreed. What God has reared up and wishes to remain, no man can tear down. In the same way, what he has destroyed and wishes to stay destroyed, no man can rebuild. The Jews' failed attempt to rebuild the temple with help from the most powerful man on earth shows how conspicuous our victory is and how it could not be attributed to the efforts of Christians to halt it because, Chrysostom says, this did not happen in the times of the good emperors. No one can say that the Christians came and prevented the work from being finished. It happened at a time when our religion was subject to persecution, when all our lives were in danger, when every man was afraid to speak, when paganism flourished. Some of the faithful hid in their homes, others fled the marketplaces and moved to the deserts. This is when these events occurred. The failure to rebuild the temple happened when Christians were powerless. Chrysostom concludes, so the Jews have no excuse left to them for their impudence. Chrysostom is under no illusion that Jewish impudence will disappear, because it became a part of their identity when they rejected Christ and would remain as long as they perdured in that rejection. The project of restoring the temple was, according to Chrysostom, traceable to the Jewish character, which by resisting the Holy Spirit has become revolutionary. What kind of men, Chrysostom asks, would rebuild the temple? The answer is simple, the revolutionary Jew, or as he puts it, they were men who constantly resisted the Holy Spirit. Revolutionists bent on stirring up sedition. After the destruction under Vespasian and Titus, these Jews rebelled during the reign of Hadrian and tried to go back to the old commonwealth and way of life. What they failed to realize was that they were fighting against the decree of God, who had ordered that Jerusalem remain forever in ruins. On February the 27th, 380 AD, the Emperor Theodosius decreed Christianity was the official religion of the Roman Empire. In 17 years, the Jews had suffered a complete reversal of fortune. The people who cried, "We have no king but Caesar," found that Caesar had suddenly become a Christian.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.